Can we delay repair of the anterior cruciate ligament in the knee?
A look at the outcomes after treatment for localized prostate cancer.
A dual strategy for managing hypertension or high blood pressure and congestive heart failure.
And do antibiotics have a role in the management of severe malnutrition?
That's what we'll be talking about on this week's look at the medical headlines from Johns Hopkins. I'm Elizabeth Tracy.
And I'm Rick Lang, professor of medicine at Johns Hopkins and vice chairman of medicine at the University of Texas in San Antonio.
Rick, since the Super Bowl is this Sunday, I think we should turn to the British Medical Journal, a look at delayed versus immediate repair of the anterior cruciate ligament. Not that I'm hoping any of these guys are going to suffer this particular injury, but you and I both know that football is notorious, especially these kind of games, for producing these kinds of injuries.
As you suggest, anterior cruciate ligament or ACL injury is fairly common in people that are very active in sports. There's a lot of controversy about how to best address this. When someone has an ACL injury, should that person be referred quickly to surgery, or should they be enrolled in rehab and then see if they can avoid surgery? So this is a very well done randomized trial of 121 young active adults that had an acute ACL injury to a knee that had not been previously injured. Half of them received early ACL repair, and the other half were assigned to a delayed strategy. They underwent rehab and then only underwent surgery if they needed it. And then they assessed the functional outcome and did this affect surgery down the road. And after the follow-up period of 5 years, there was no difference in pain, the functional activities of daily living, their ability to function in sports or recreation, no difference in the general health of the patients, and no difference in objective measurements such as x-rays of the knees. So in short, a strategy of rehabilitation plus delayed surgery was just as good as immediate surgery. More importantly, for those that had the delayed strategy, 50% of them did not require surgery.
Yeah, if we wait, if we say, you know, let's just step back here and let's not run right off to the OR, what happens? And you've just told me 50% of these people didn't need surgery, which I would have to say, I'm not even remotely surprised. That's not my question, however, it's just my editorializing. My question is, what would be the factors that would say to us it's appropriate to delay surgery?
It sounds like in this patient population, the groups are just too small to address that question. What I would say is there doesn't appear to be any harm to a delayed surgical strategy.
And I'm going to editorialize just a little further, and I know that doesn't surprise you at all, and say that we know that long-term data show us that once we penetrate the joint capsule, that arthritis will develop over time. And so in my mind, well worth waiting to see if you need it or if you don't.
And in fact, somewhere between 10 and 20% of these individuals on either side required some additional surgery as well to take care of the issues that you're addressing.
So any of those guys who suffer any kind of injury in this week's Super Bowl to their ACL, we're going to say, wait, especially because the football season's over. From there then, why don't we just stay in the British Medical Journal, something I served up as a dual strategy for managing something called the renin-angiotensin system. It's important both in high blood pressure, but also in congestive heart failure.
This is one of the neurohormonal systems that regulates blood pressure and regulates our response to congestive heart failure as well. Individuals with high blood pressure can have an elevation in these neurohormones, and in people with heart failure, they certainly have an elevation. There's a single pathway, but multiple ways to inhibit that pathway. We call those angiotensin receptor blockers or angiotensin converting enzyme inhibitors, two different classes of medications that all act in the same pathway. If you use two different ways of blocking that pathway as opposed to one, is there any benefit? There's some controversy. It's possible you could have worse side effects. So this was a systematic review, a meta-analysis of all studies conducted between 1990 and 2012 that compared dual blockade versus monotherapy. They looked at 33 randomized trials of over 68,000 patients. What they found was that there was no benefit in terms of reduced mortality with using dual therapy. There was a slight decrease in hospitalizations for heart failure, about an 18% decrease with dual therapy. But here's the caveat. If you had dual therapy, there was a 66% increase in the risk of having hypotension and a 41% risk of having kidney failure. So in essence, there's no mortality benefit and the significant downside. In the United States alone, there's almost a 250,000 individuals that we know of taking dual therapy.
Of course, we know that the management of hypertension sometimes requires more than one agent. Is that the primary indication for having these folks on more than one drug?
That often is. If you look at just across the board, people need an average of 2.7 medications to control their blood pressure. This isn't telling people don't take more than one medication. This is saying don't use dual therapy in the same pathway.
Which of these then, of these two different types of agents we use to modify this pathway, is associated with fewer side effects?
The angiotensin receptor blockers, that's the ARBs, they have less side effects than the ACE inhibitors. We have a much longer experience with ACE inhibitors, many more studies showing that they're very efficacious, fewer studies with ARBs.
So that sounds like back to one's primary care doc and a bunch of questions about how it feels for someone.
You're right. The nice thing is we have two different medications for the same pathway, but we just shouldn't use them together.
Okay. From here then, let's go to the New England Journal of Medicine, something I think is a really provocative idea, antibiotics for severe malnutrition.
Elizabeth, if I had to ask you to guess how many children die of malnutrition each year, would you know worldwide?
Worldwide. Oh, worldwide. It's a really huge number. I was going to say here in the U.S., it's really probably not that high.
You're right. Not that high in the U.S., but worldwide, about 1 million children die each year. We have found effective therapy, if we can get it to them. That's what's called ready-to-use therapeutic food. And it's usually a fortified spread that consists of peanut paste and milk powder, oil, sugar, and some micronutrient supplements. But even giving this RUTF, the ready-to-use therapeutic food, about 10 to 15% of children still don't recover, and their mortality is high. Part of the reason they die is there's a very high risk of significant infections. So this is an interesting study. If we gave them a week of antibiotics, would that reduce their mortality? And what they discovered was kids that received antibiotics, it reduced mortality between 36 and 44%. So this is really important news.
Is the administration of these antibiotics oral?
These are oral antibiotics, routinely available. Your next question, where was this study conducted, and is this cost prohibitive? This was done in Malawi, sub-Saharan Africa. These are rural health clinics. The antibiotic, one of them cost about $2.67 for treatment. The other cost about $7.68.
Excellent news. On that good note, then, I'm going to leave that one alone and turn to another study in this week's NEJM, something that we keep talking about and talking about, prostatectomy and irradiation for a localized disease in prostate cancer.
Prostate cancer is really ubiquitous in older gentlemen. In general, once a man is diagnosed with prostate cancer, his survival on average is about 14 years. So this was a study looking at the functional outcome of two different treatments. This looked at how men do with regard to their urinary, their bowel, and their sexual function after receiving either a radical prostatectomy or external beam radiation. So this was a cohort of over 1,600 men and underwent either surgery or radiotherapy and were followed for 2 years, 5 years, and 15 years, the longest term follow-up that we have. What we discovered were two things, that regardless of the treatment, patients had significant declines in their sexual and urinary function over the duration of the study. Now, some of this is probably related to the treatment, but some of it's just related to the age. What they did find was that men who underwent prostatectomy were five times as likely as those who underwent radiotherapy to have urinary incontinence and twice as likely to have erectile dysfunction at 5 years. But at 15 years, there was no difference.
Right, but the outcome was similar because of aging factors, not because of treatment factors.
Well, Elizabeth, that's a good hypothesis, but this study actually can't address that. One could say some of these effects were beginning to be seen at 5 years and continued on. If it was just due to aging alone, you might presume that whatever differences there were at 5 years would be the same at 15 years, but it didn't. Those gaps narrowed. So again, part of it could be due to aging, and part of it could be due to the treatments. Unfortunately, this study doesn't unravel that.
Right. But I guess if I put myself into the place of someone who's trying to decide whether I want to have external beam radiation or prostatectomy, based on this intermediate assessment, I think I would like to preserve my urinary continence and my sexual function in the short term.
The nice thing about this study is it provides that data so men can make an informed, educated decision about what they want to do. That's why I think this study is particularly germane and provides that information to individuals. How do you want to be living at 2 years and 5 years and 15 years? What do you want to give up? What are the trade-offs? What are the risks and benefits of both? So an extremely well-done study. Which, by the way, of these four studies do you want to highlight this week?
Well, I'm going to do the ACL repair because it's timely with the Super Bowl on Sunday.
So I expect to see some pictures of some football players on our blog site, or maybe a soccer player.
Okay. So that's a look at this week's medical headlines from Johns Hopkins. I'm Elizabeth Tracy.
And I'm Rick Lang. Y'all live well.